directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
Democracy Now.
There's been talk already about folks getting offers on their homes, and I know from friends that that's happening. But as I mentioned, there's also water grab in the works, and the discussion about.
I'm on my way home. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah. Good afternoon, everyone. You just listened to Elliot Maguino, Emilio Any Day Now. And before that, you heard, dear God, Ali, I forgot, of course.
You're listening to Can You Get to That by Funkadelic, one of my favorite funk songs ever.
Awesome. Love my short-term memory. Thank you.
You're listening to 90.3 FM. This is Steminism. Sorry for the kind of slow, frazzled start. We're all coming from experiments and such, but we are really excited to be here and talk about science with you today. So, thank you just so much for tuning in. We're really excited to be here. And again, my name is Ali. You just heard from Amelie, and I'm going to have Noor introduce our topic for today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ali, for the introduction. So, I guess that today's topic is not super surprising. And that is because climate change is happening, and it's actually, I think, at an all-time high. The world's hottest temperature ever was recorded this month, like in July. It was one of the hottest temperatures that the world has gotten to. And about 200 million people are going to be displaced due to climate change by 2050 if we keep on this trend. So it's clearly a big issue. What are the most shocking things that you guys have seen since the climate crisis has begun?
Well, there was one summer that I was living in Portland, Oregon in the U.S., and we had a heat wave that got to like 42, 43 degrees Celsius, and it was like you walked outside and just felt like a blanket was put over you. It was so hot. And I mean, the Pacific Northwest of the U.S. never really gets above, I don't know, like high, you know, mid 30s, so for it to be almost mid 40s was actually horrible. And I think at least 40 people died that summer. Ooh. And there were a lot of like homeless encampments where tents just lit up on fire.
Oh wow.
And we don't know if it was like it caught on fire from fires that they were burning to cook, or if it was spontaneous combustion. People claim it was spontaneous combustion, but I don't know. But it was really, really, really hot that summer. It was like 2 years ago.
That's absolutely crazy. Yeah. Erica. Hi, Erica just joined.
Hello. I ran up the hill.
Yes. And what would you say was the most shocking thing that you encountered during like this ongoing climate crisis that we're facing?
Personally, I haven't had the craziest of experiences compared to some of my friends who have actually, like, they live in the Northwest Territories, mm-hmm. and a couple of them have actually been displaced, and they've been forced to evacuate. So that was a pretty recent development. I think that happened a couple of days ago.
Wow.
And I was reading a post about it, and the craziest, or one of the craziest things to me was, at the bottom they mentioned, oh, like, we're praying for, you know, the pets that we had to leave behind.
Oh, my God. That's pretty,
I think,
sad. That's
roads
horrible.
Had been blocked off, like people just couldn't go home.
Oof.
Yeah.
That's literally heartbreaking.
Yeah. You think it's, I don't know, I guess when it's so far away, you don't always have to think about it. And sometimes I've been putting it out of my mind because it's not, you know, happening where mm-hmm. I live, but now it's happening in Canada, and I think it's going to be happening everywhere pretty right. much soon, which is really scary to think about.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we got a taste of it here in Montreal, right, with the whole smoke that engulfed the city mm-hmm. for a while, and it made it very difficult for us to breathe. And I think it's just going to keep getting worse, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it's so unfortunate, like, also, like, how people are forced to leave pets behind. Like, they couldn't
Get home to get back to them to pick them up.
Like, this is horrible.
Yeah.
This is absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
Like,
and it's very real. Like, it's happening. It's happening to Canadians. It's happening to people all over the world.
It's happening,
like,
to people you know.
Yeah.
It's not just, like, some statistics
some distant,
that you
yeah.
could, you know, neglect.
Throw in the back of your mind and be like, oh, this is terrible. But, you know, I'm okay. My family's okay. You
yeah.
know, this is not the reality anymore. It's affecting
mm-hmm.
people in our social circles. And
it's happening all over the world, too. Yeah, and you'd think, you know, with all of that happening, that the world leaders would somehow get their shit together basically make a yeah, like, we have all these world leaders, we have all these scientists, we have all the different research that has been published. Actually, the greenhouse effect was discovered about 150 years ago, and it's so far, and it's been so long, and there's still people out there that deny that climate change is a thing. They deny that global warming is happening with all the wildfires and the fact that 80% of the Arctic ice has melted.
Mm-hmm.
80%, that's crazy. And still there's people out there that deny that.
Well, I see a lot of people denying it because of the really cold winters that we've also been seeing, because back to, you know, living in the Pacific Northwest, like, we had very mild winters and very mild summers. It was always kind of a, you know, not a lot of temperature change, just rainy, mild temperatures. But along with those really hot heat waves we've been getting, we've also been getting these crazy ice storms.
Mm-hmm.
And we get snow every single year now. We only ever had snow, like, once every 5 years growing up as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see a lot of people that say, like, well, it's, I don't believe in global warming. If these winters are cold, it's not warm. And so I think that's also a misconception
yeah.
that a lot of people are having.
Yeah, and what they don't get, it's climate change, right? It's getting more extreme. We're getting
yeah.
more of the extreme winters and more of the extreme summers and the storms. And just because we feel cold doesn't mean the world isn't getting hotter.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Just because it's colder in one area doesn't mean that it's not hotter in one area. Like,
yeah.
the whole point of it is that there's a kind of compensation that's our climate is trying to account for. These extreme temperatures, there's going to be more wind trying to transfer the warm air to the colder regions and vice versa.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the cold, the extreme cold is just an effect of the extreme heat somewhere else. You don't just get extreme cold out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was reading about how with the ice caps melting, there's viruses and, like, diseases from, like, you know, thousands and millions of years ago that are now being thawed.
Oh my god. Oh, the anthrax. I read about the anthrax from a deer, and it hit a neighboring population.
Oh
yeah,
I didn't
Seriously.
Know that.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
I don't know how big the population that it hit was, but yeah, it thawed and it infected people.
This is crazy.
Yeah,
this is absolutely crazy. Yeah, these are some trying times, fellow listeners from wherever you are. But I guess today it's important to acknowledge when the discovery was first made and to see how far the science has come since then. But I would like to take us back to about, like, 150 years ago when the discovery was made. So everyone knows, when we look up the greenhouse effect, everyone knows that the person who discovered it was Tyndall. John Tyndall, he's the person who's accredited to the discovery. But what we don't know is that actually it was discovered 3 years prior by a woman scientist. Her name is Eunice Newton Foote, and she made that discovery herself. She had made experiments. She put different gases in tubes and exposed them to sunlight and measured the temperature differences, and she found that humidity and particularly carbon dioxide actually resulted in increased temperatures compared to regular atmospheric gas. And she theorized that there's this greenhouse effect that was going on. But because she was, one, a woman, and two, she could not present her own findings, so someone presented her findings on her behalf in one of those big scientific conferences that occurred. And her findings were just some reports on like a conference, some conference proceedings. And because back then science was not properly communicated, especially between oceans, it seems like that effect was later rediscovered a few years later, and so it was attributed to John Tyndall. Now, it seems like it was just a matter of misinformation. It wasn't...
There wasn't a lot of communication.
There wasn't a lot of communication.
Yeah.
But John Tyndall himself did not believe that women deserved to be in science. So he actually thought that women were inferior. He even noted this down, saying, oh yeah, women are more better at feeling than they are at intellect.
Quote, and more feeling and less intellect than men.
Pretty much.
And openly opposed women's suffrage.
Yes.
He sounds like a great fellow.
Absolutely.
What a winner.
Yeah.
What a winner.
And it kind of blows my mind, you guys. Like, we condemn so many people in history for having horrible beliefs about people and having prejudice against different groups, whether it's racial groups or others. But if a person literally believed that women were inferior, it's surprising how society just lets it slide. Like, oh yeah, these were the times back then. Like, this is how society functioned back then. As if that somehow excuses that. And
taking someone else's work.
Pretty much. Yeah. Though, technically, yeah, it is. It may have not been an active effort of him taking someone else's work, but it is definitely a classic example of the Matilda effect, which is basically attributing women's scientific findings to men, like what happened with Rosalind Franklin and Watson and Crick and the DNA model. Mm-hmm. So it's, and you know, it was actually discovered by accident. So there was this researcher, his name is Dr. Sorensen, and in his pastimes, he just enjoyed reading different old scientific articles, and he happened to come across this conference proceeding from 1857 and he noticed that the greenhouse effect was reported by this woman scientist, Dr. Foote, and he was like, oh wait a minute, I've seen this before. Wasn't that effect discovered in 1859 by this man? Why is there something back in 1857 that was written by a woman? And it's just crazy to think about how it was just by pure coincidence. Like, if it weren't for this discovery, then maybe we would have gone our whole lives without knowing that she's the one who made the discovery. And she's made a lot of amazing and impressive research since, but it's crazy to think about the fact that one of the most important things that clearly have drastic effects on our lives right now or have been misattributed and continue to be misattributed. Like, if you Google it, you're gonna get this guy's name first, and then you'll get some articles about how she's the one who actually discovered it first, but
he's still the default answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous, I think. And I would say that it just makes you think about all of the other discoveries that have been misattributed that we just haven't figured out because the record is lost.
Yeah, because it's hidden in some book deep down somewhere.
And maybe it's not even written in a book, you know? Like, there's a lot of scientists that didn't even allow women to be present at institutions, at conferences. Like, women weren't allowed into science for a very, very long time. So clearly there's a lot to unpack that we don't know about.
Yeah, someone needs to fact check me on this, but I remember someone telling me that it was either like Einstein's wife or sister, like some woman in his life, actually contributed to a lot of his ideas without any acknowledgement whatsoever. And like, he's one of the most famous scientists ever.
Literally.
Did she had a Like, do we know her background?
I need to look it up.
But I heard that too.
Yeah. I've heard it several times. Yeah.
But again, fact check that. Someone.
Yeah. Because I know that a lot of Einstein's ideas, like, he wasn't super mathy, but he was great at coming up with the questions and the theories. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it would be really interesting if maybe that was a reason why he had someone helping him out with those. But
yeah. And this also extends to, you know, not just science, too. Like, in every aspect of life, I think often women are undermined by the men in their lives. Like, for example, it happens all the time in art, too. Like, I know it's a really famous story of Margaret Keane, who she drew these, like, really beautiful paintings of, like, women with really big eyes, but her husband Walter would sell them as his own and became really famous mm-hmm. for her paintings. Mm-hmm. And so it's just... It's really everywhere. It's really apparent in a lot of different aspects of life and talent and occupations, professions. It's really just women aren't allowed to be successful and innovative and creative and intelligent, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. They made a movie about this called Big
Eyes.
Yeah,
I haven't seen that one.
I highly recommend it. It was released in 2014, and the movie is called Big Eyes. And actually, Lana Del Rey made this song for that movie, also called Big Eyes.
Love Lana.
Yeah. It's a very good movie, and it's I think it captures the story quite well. So what do you guys think, like, would happen if we took this event, this discovery that was made back then, but what if it happened now? Like, what if you came across an article that you found was published on, I don't know, BioArchive, of some big discovery that was made? And it was made by a different scientist than the person that the discovery was attributed to. What would you guys do, I think? Like, how do you think you would respond as a scientist? How do you think the community would respond? Like, the modern scientific community. Do you think that especially when the gender roles come into play, do you think that nowadays it would still be an issue? Or do you think that society has gotten past this point?
Well, I would hope that it's easier now to rectify the situation because we have Google and, like, the internet and actual evidence. Mm-hmm. And it's really easy to just link the original article. And then we have Twitter, where at least scientists, it's still used by scientists, I think. And there's going to be a discussion where someone's like, hey, this is wrong. Please, correct it.
Right. Right. That is, we would hope for that.
In an ideal world, absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly.
I think I think we're in that realm, obviously. But I think that sometimes there's still going to be people who are, I guess, masking their true beliefs and thoughts. I've come across some people, just as a measly student, mm-hmm. Who, like, fully believe that women should not be in science.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'd love to say that everyone would be honest and credit would be attributed to who it should be attributed to. And I think in most cases that is true, but I don't think it would be unheard of if a couple did slip through the cracks.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that is true. And there's a lot that happens under the hood as well. Like, within the lab or the institution itself, we don't know out of all the published papers out there if the first author was actually the person who made the work.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, it could be much less nefarious than completely leaving someone off of a project. Mm-hmm. It could be as simple as, like, pushing them back when they've actually done most of the work or most of the writing.
Absolutely, yeah. Or presenting the work at a conference. And see, even if someone does give credit to their students, I feel like when someone is presenting the work of their students at a conference, there's a right way to do it, and it's by emphasizing the students' effort. But I find that a lot of professors nowadays will, like, present all the data and stuff, and then at the end of the presentation, they'll have, like, an acknowledgement slide saying, oh yeah, all this work has been done by X and Y grad students at my lab, and then they'll end the talk and they'll ask questions, and it's like
It's passed by. It's kind of, it's a little bit overlooked, but acknowledgements are still given. It's just
I had one professor once who would, for each slide that had data presented, they would have a little picture of the person who made the graph or analyzed the data with their name underneath it. That's and great. I think that was a really wonderful way to give acknowledgement to students and people that aren't, you know, PIs, they're not the head of their field yet, but they're still contributing work and they're what's making your lab function. And so even if they didn't mention their name, like you could still see a little picture of them and their name. And oftentimes she would shout them out, be like, and, you know, thanks to this person for making this graph. And I think that was a really, really quick, easy, wonderful way to acknowledge the work behind your results that you're presenting.
Absolutely.
Also, something that people outside of science might not be aware of is that the actual research is rarely done by the PIs, so the person who owns the lab. They usually don't have enough time to do the whole analysis part or like treat their cells or, you know, stat at the bench, whatever your research is on. Their job is to secure the funding and do all the admin work and hire the right people and represent the lab at conferences and stuff, but the actual research part is done by the students and the postdocs. So the little tiny people in the back that don't get mentioned or that are not at the conferences because they're doing the research.
Yeah. Yes. It was really cute because my current mentor, who's wonderful and brilliant, she sent us a picture of her when she was in her postdoc at the bench and to prove that she used to do wet lab work. And I thought that was really funny. And it's also really wonderful to see her, like a picture of her doing work at like kind of my age, right? Because it was like, I can be like her one day, you know, I can be the one funding this lab and mentoring other women and other young scientists. And it was... But that's a really good point. Like,
it's adorable.
No, it was wonderful. I'm so glad you sent it. But I think your point is absolutely correct. Like, people don't realize that these big names that you're reading, like, they deserve, most of the time, deserve to be where they're at. They've, you know, made wonderful contributions. They're brilliant. They're smart, kind, wonderful people. But in that current moment, they're not usually the ones who are contributing to the actual production of the data itself. To be fair, they are mentoring and they're funding the lab ultimately.
And they've made their contribution in the past.
Yes, exactly.
Like they worked their way up there. Yeah. That's fine.
And they teach the students like how to do some techniques. They advise them on which direction to take their project. They tell them they advise them on which experiments they should run and which ones they shouldn't. Of course, it varies from one supervisor to another. I know some of them are very hands-on and some of them are incredibly hands-off, but in general it is very important, I think, to acknowledge.
I agree. I don't think it's ever going to be bad to acknowledge who is helpful and, you know, a part of your lab and doing wonderful work. Like, at the end of the day, you're only making it better for everyone and making people feel recognized and seen, which makes them want to do better work as well. I think acknowledgement and recognition will always be a good thing at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Do you think that this is something that, at least if we want to look like 20 years into the future, if, you know, we survive the climate crisis so far and the world doesn't explode, but
big if
do you think that conferences will show a higher attendance by students early on in their careers? Like, do you foresee a shift in the attention that we give researchers?
I hope so, considering that we're the future of the scientists and PIs that are mentoring us now. I think I feel like I've talked to a lot of people that share the same sentiments as us in our own program here at McGill. So that makes me really hopeful that just our generation in general will provide a really hospitable future for the young scientists of our future. At least that's my hope.
And you imagine yourself doing exactly that.
I hope
when
so.
When you hopefully become a professor.
I really hope that I have the same views that I do now. I don't know why I wouldn't, but I'm very dead set in my views right now. And I really enjoy seeing my friends and peers be successful and happy, and I'm happy when people are happy for me as well. I think that science is something that we should all enjoy doing together and celebrate all their successes, because at the end of the day, everyone's success is contributing to a better society and health and medicine and in general, it's all good, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that I still believe that when I'm an older PI with my own students that I'm mentoring and I'm busy and I'm stressed and anxious, like I hope that I still have these same sentiments. So hopefully this recording will still be on the internet when I'm, you know, 40 years older than I am now, so I can send back to it and this remind myself.
Recorded?
Yes. Yes, it is. Gotta be careful about what I say.
Yeah. Those early profanities are
I'm
gonna
so
make
sorry.
It. It'll live forever on the internet, Erica. Yeah.
And even if it's not on the internet anymore, we'll be here to remind you.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll have the hopefully. Same discussion. Who knows?
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I really hope so. I can't wait. Thank you.
Yeah. Do you want to cut to a music break?
Yes. I really want to play this song called Blue Jeans Blue or Blue Jean Blue by Coton Guete, which is a Montreal band. I think they're Montreal. I know they're for sure Quebec, but this music video takes place in Montreal.
Okay.
And it's a really fun song. It's about like looking out the window to see what other people are wearing so that you can decide what you're going to wear that day based on the weather.
I
love that band. That's so funny.
Yeah, they're so good. Amazing. I'm glad you like them.
Yes. Let's listen to it.
Tu bien dans ton coton ouaté? Hey! Y'a l'air de faire frais. T'es-tu bien dans ton coton ouaté? Si dehors il fait beau, mais que ça a pas l'air chaud chaud, je m'installe debout devant ma bay window pour savoir si c'est une journée de petite laine ou de kiwi. Je me fie sur le passant le moins habillé. C'est là que j'ouvre ma fenêtre et sans me gêner. Je lui demande comme si c'était mon bon body. J'ai dit, hey, fais-tu frette? On est-tu bien juste en coton ouaté? Hey, y'a l'air de faire frette. T'es-tu bien dans ton coton ouaté? Lorsque vous êtes ambigu à propos de votre tenue, regardez les gens défiler dans la rue. Un col en vie, un col roulé. Est-ce une bonne journée pour sortir en bustier? Un pantacourt ou un pantalon? Grosse combine ou ben bas de nylon? Une bonne paire de Kodiak? Ou un bas blanc dans vos sandales? On se laisse influencer par comment le monde est habillé. Mais pourquoi espionner en cachette? Y'a pas de honte à faire la blette. Dites hey! Faites fret! On est-tu bien juste en coton ouaté? Y'a l'air de faire frette, t'es-tu bien dans ton coton ouaté? Hey, fais-tu frette? On est-tu bien juste en coton ouaté? Hey, y'a l'air de faire frette, t'es-tu bien dans ton coton ouaté?
Okay, on another note, since we're talking about women who were largely uncredited, I think it's also cool to listen to this song, Big Eyes, by Lana Del Rey, which is about this artist that we talked about earlier.
With your big eyes
All right. Once again, you're listening to 90.3 CKUT Radio. You're listening to STEMinism with Ali, Amelie, Erica, and Noor. Thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate it. We will be hosting this show every third Friday of the month. So if you're enjoying what you're listening to, please tune in next time. We really, really appreciate that you're here. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ali. So you were talking earlier about... So still within the topic of women who are underappreciated in science for being women, you just mentioned something that kind of shocked me.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I was telling them about Ben Barres, which is he's a neuroscientist. I believe he worked at Stanford. And he wrote a memoir that I really want to read. I've heard really wonderful things about it. But essentially the gist of it is that he was born a woman, a really successful neuroscientist, did great work, and then transitioned midway through his career. And he was saying that once he was at some conferences and he overheard people saying that, like, oh, you know, that sister of Ben Barres was way worse scientist than he is, not putting together that it's the exact same person. And so he really didn't quite understand, like, he always knew that there was sexism related to being a woman and that you just face that every day, but it wasn't until he, like, identified as a male and was a male presenting scientist that he truly understood that dichotomy between women and men scientists, and the fact that the same person's work was seen as worse because it was produced by a woman is just, I think, flabbergasting.
It's so interesting to have someone with both perspectives, mm-hmm. because usually we don't get the other perspective, right?
Yeah.
And then to have someone who has both of them, his research didn't change.
No,
right?
He's the same
person. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
But that it's treated differently is just...
Just by the gender. And I think that's a really wonderful example whenever, like, a man tells you, like, that sexism doesn't exist anymore, like, it's not real, there is no bias, like...
The bias is built in.
It's there. Like, this is the perfect example of, like, no, someone has experienced what it's like to be a woman and seen as a man in science, and people legitimately believe that his work was worse when he was identifying as a woman. Like... It's there, it's real, like, it's systemic.
Absolutely. It's like, it's woven into the fabric of our society, like, how badly, like, these biases are ingrained. And, like, I sometimes even find them within myself. Like, I find that a lot of my own, like, insecurities as, you know, a woman in science, I find that a lot of them come from this, like, bias that society has kind of projected onto us growing up, like, oh, you're a woman, like, you're not supposed to be doing this kind of work. And even though this is kind of outdated, it's still kind of present in, you know, the more traditional societies where they find that, oh, you cannot, like, marry a woman who is this ambitious, mm-hmm. or if I say that, oh yeah, I want to do a PhD, I want to become a professor, they're like, oh, what about kids, like, when are you, like, what? How are you going to live your life if that's what you're planning on doing? And men never get asked
these
questions.
They never get those questions.
Never, ever. And it's so interesting to get the perspective of someone who had both experiences. And this is also common in pretty much outside of in any kind of sphere where someone transitioned in their lives. Many of them have reported feeling that they would report feeling like, oh, they grew up with a lot of self-doubt and a lot of... lack of confidence and social anxiety, and then they would transition and become male presenting, and then they'd realize, like, wait a minute, I'm suddenly being treated with so much respect.
Mm-hmm.
People don't talk to me in a way that somehow makes me doubt what I'm saying, or makes me have to defend myself mm-hmm. at every instance, or feel like I'm being too emotional, or feel like I am being too much of anything. So that perspective is very important to have, for sure.
Yeah. For anyone who's still unsure if we have sexism in science, there was a book published just this year. It's called Equity for Women in Science by Cassidy Sugimoto and Vincent Lariviere. And they talk about how, like, for example, papers from women are still cited less than papers from men. Which is very fascinating to me, but because in scientific papers, you usually only read the last name, and like the first name is only the initial, in most cases at least. And I usually don't even, I don't look it up. Like, I don't care. And like, how is that possible?
Like, could it be, do you think it could be explained by the fact that it, because the society has kind of made it very difficult for women to get into science, that it's a statistical thing? Or do you think that they show in the book that there's an inherent bias, like taking all of these factors into account, like even with this being taken into account and the proportions?
The letter. I don't know how, but the letter.
Wow, this is crazy.
Yep.
This is absolutely crazy. Maybe like when they when women submit their papers to journals, the journals are able to see that the researcher is a woman, and there's an inherent bias there. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's sad.
Yeah.
It's like the same work, and if they just slapped a male name on it, it might be cited more.
Yeah. How do you guys feel like if you open an amazing scientific paper and you see that it was written by a woman?
I mean, it's not like I actually care initially. Yeah. Like, I care about the science behind it, and I'm just excited that it's, like, exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's always great to, like, feel represented, and it's always, like, a little reassurance that I'll be able to make it at some point. Like, just in theory, it's possible.
Right.
Of course, I still have to put in the work, but, also in conferences, whenever I see a woman up there, I'm like, okay, yes.
Yeah.
This is
empowering.
It's a riot that I'm like trying to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. I feel like this is an amazing feeling. Like, at least I think, especially when I see like a Middle Eastern woman specifically, like be like a first author on some top notch paper. I'm like, hell yeah, this is what we're doing here. Like, it's not just, especially because in the Middle Eastern societies, there's still a lot of projections on women to fulfill their social roles. Nowadays, there's a lot of pushback. And so there's a lot of people who are very progressive, and they're able to like support women choosing to have, you know, more ambitious pursuits that go beyond being someone who takes care of the house or someone who raises children. And not to discredit this, because this is also something that is very important and very essential for life. But it's good to have the choice, and it's good to be treated like you have the choice. So it's always empowering to see that, you know, like, or like a top-notch keynote speaker being like a woman from the Middle East. It's pretty cool.
Another thing that I've noticed, and you know, like, might be a contributing factor to this kind of bias, is I think the difference in the way that men and women present themselves and present their findings. Men are always very convinced of, they're very confident, they're like infallible almost, whereas a lot of women who I've talked to in science, not that they're not convinced, but sometimes they don't want to oversell themselves.
Right.
And so maybe it's just a difference in the writing. You know, you're like, maybe women aren't promising as much, you know, ideas of grandeur as men are. And, you know, and so things seem less shiny I think it's also maybe another contributing factor to the fact that there's more male PIs than there are female PIs. I think a big part of it is just the way, like, you really have to sell yourself. And I'm not convinced that women love doing that, just because we're more, like, women tend to be a little bit more realistic or, like, down to earth. I don't want to say that, but it's just something I've noticed when talking to female scientists, is that there's less of this is absolutely how it is, and more of like, this is how I interpreted it.
Yeah.
Which is the right thing to do it. like the right way to do it. I'm sorry.
But it's less shiny. That's the only difference. Yes.
But what I find so sad about this is that in science, it's all about facts, mm-hmm. right? Like we're supposed to just look at the data and not like interpret too much about it. So the way women supposedly do it, that's like the factual way of doing it. And
like, you should be approaching things critically. Exactly. Always.
And like not just randomly promise.
Yeah. Stuff. Nothing's ever a fact. Things are just theories that need to be supported.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. This is something that I find the public also struggles to grapple with. Science is like, you can't actually take anything for granted. You don't really have something that is a fact that you cannot disprove. All we have is theories with a lot of evidence to back them up that we can then say is a scientific fact, in quotes. But you know, there's something about, so going back to Erica, what you were talking about, the language and how women like talk about their own science and their own achievements, I find that to be very true, because what I've realized now as a grad student, now that I'm writing applications to different grants and different funding sources, a lot of what, like the recognition that you will receive, has a lot to do with your PR and how you sell yourself. A lot of it has to do with the language. Like, how are you able to prove to the public, to the funders, that what you're doing is actually important? Because the fact of the matter is, a lot of funders are not actually in science. They are in some big companies, they have a lot of money, but they don't necessarily have a scientific background. And even the ones that do have a scientific background, it might not necessarily be within your own field. So a lot of science rides on being able to sell yourself. And I would say that definitely, yes, women have less of a propensity to do that because of a multitude of factors. Like, one, in general in society, all they've been facing so far is not encouragement, but discouragement from becoming scientists. Whereas all that men have been exposed to, at least like in my country, in Lebanon, it's like they see a young kid tinkering with a toy and they're like, oh yeah, you're gonna become an engineer. They see a woman doing this and they're like, oh, why are you dirtying your hands? Like, you should do something else. Like, oh, that's not very ladylike, you know? You should go sit somewhere or do something else. So I feel like a lot of that contributes to this lack of self-confidence. Like, I find it in myself when I'm writing applications, but I find that a lot of people can also relate. Like, I'm sure you all can relate just how difficult it is to sell yourself and to say, I deserve to be here, I am worthy. You feel like you always have to kind of defend yourself somehow. Like, that's our default mode when we're trying to present our ideas. We already feel that we're under attack, even when there is no attack, because that's the soil that we grew up in. It's all just doubt.
Yeah, I would never want to overpromise something in a grant that I, you know, I would never want to say, oh, my research is gonna, you know, contribute to this and this and this, and I'm gonna help cure this disease, when that's not just not true. And I don't know, I would just feel this dishonesty within myself. And I just naturally kind of stray away from that kind of thing. But I know people who, I mean, I've talked to some male friends in the field as well, and they tell me, like, no, you just have to write this. Yeah. You just have to say this.
Yeah. And it's true. And the fact is, they're right. You do. Yeah. Like, in order to get what we deserve, and in order to, like, achieve and to put our science out there and to get the grant money and to get the funding and to stay in our positions, we need to sell ourselves and we need to be confident and we need to be very assertive in what we're saying. Nope. And this starts with the emails, right? Like, when you're writing an email, instead of saying, oh, I think that this might be,
thanks, exclamation mark, exclamation
yeah,
mark,
so many exclamation mark. I'm like, thank smiley you again. Face, I really yeah. appreciate thank I really you. Appreciate thank you so much.
Let me know if you don't agree. I'll just completely change everything that I wrote. You know, let me know what you think. Meanwhile.
Yeah.
But if you can't get to this, it's no problem. I'll figure it out.
An anecdote on this point. When I applied to McGill, I asked one of my supervisors from London for help. And she did a mock interview with me, like, before I had the interview with Ed and Joe. And she was like, yeah, don't be so humble. Like, I love you for being humble, but this is not the place to be it. Yeah. And I didn't understand how true that is until I read the LinkedIn page of a man who got into the same program we're in. And like he wrote something along the lines of, during this year, I'll have the opportunity to like support the scientists here and like do groundbreaking science. And I'm like,
eye roll.
You're rotating and like lab, you know nothing. Like, how are you?
But also, we do need to give ourselves that confidence too, right? Like, we need to tell ourselves, yeah, we'll be doing this groundbreaking science. Like, we'll be going to a top institution. And
but, like, internally, it feels so wrong because I know what the reality of it is like. And I'm sorry.
Of course.
Do you feel like there's a fine balance that both ends need to get to?
Absolutely.
We
need to
compensation like, in either direction.
We need to like average and rebalance the number of like the amount of ego that we have.
Also, the flowery language is exhausting.
But
also, LinkedIn is killing me slowly.
LinkedIn is
I think
the most horrible social platform to exist.
LinkedIn stresses me out.
So toxic.
I just see people like post about how they like, they'll pick the most random job that anyone can do. Like I don't know. I know someone who graded exams for undergrads or something. And he, I don't even remember the language he used, but he used words I've never heard in my life to make it sound like the coolest job ever. And that he's, like, the smartest man. And that he's, you know, like, he applied to this amongst other people and he got this position over other people and it was like a really hard position to attain. And I was like, you graded exams. Like, it's just people can twist anything to make it look really grandiose and amazing. And I think it's, and I feel like I see that more from guys.
It's true. But also I feel like it's also motivated by the fact that in order to get positions, that's what they're looking for.
Yeah, you have to twist your story in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I do think I need to learn how to twist my story in a way to makes it look more appealing and, you know, appetizing. But at the same time, I think you can twist something too much.
Absolutely.
I think, again, there's a balance.
There is a balance.
Yeah. Not if everything deserves a LinkedIn post, people.
If I see one more post on LinkedIn that's like, I'm happy to announce that I got this certificate from LinkedIn, I'm going to vomit.
Yeah.
The LinkedIn certificate. Yeah, no.
to get it. Funny. Yeah, like, I feel like some, like, it's a balance, you know. You need to sell yourself. Also, the job market is kind of tough out there, depending on which field you're in. Sometimes you have to like go all out and just really put yourself out there, because like especially in corporations, they'll sift through the like applications. Like, literally, I heard from a friend who worked in HR at a company. They had like a whole stack of job applications, and then I think her boss was like, oh yeah, like any resume that does not have like this word in it, just remove it.
Yeah, like, honestly, nowadays it's just about the buzzwords.
It is about the buzzwords.
It's only like they all use AI now, and it's just sifting through the applications looking for like the three main words they want, whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is. How do you guys feel about AI being used in job applications? Because a lot of language models have an inherent bias. It's actually something that we explored in the convergence art class that I took, which like was neuroscience, art, and society. We looked at one of the AI art like generators, and I kept typing like successful CEO, successful doctor, successful, like all these big positions. And they would always show pictures of a man. And every time I'd write something like, oh, caring parent, like I wouldn't even gender that parent, but it would always show like a woman in that role. Any kind of low income job would always be given to the minority groups, so people of color or immigrants, that these are the people that are depicted. And then the people, like, all everything that is successful would always show, like, the dominant.
We love having our biases. what's the word? Reaffirmed.
Reaffirmed biases, yes. Yeah. And that kind of concerns me, you know, when AI is being used for job applications, something that can literally make it or break it for someone in their lives. Like, I'm sure that the languages that they, like, the models that they train should account for that, but there's been a lot of articles which show that in some companies there is a bias in the model because the training data is biased, and it just keeps...
If you don't have proper representation in the training data, you're not going to have... The model's just not going to be trained properly.
Exactly, course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It is... I think it is very reductive. I think it's probably where the world is now, but I could still feel negatively about it.
Yeah, it is where the world is now, and, like, I would hope at least there is a big movement from my undergrad university. There's this professor, Dr. Awad, she works in AI, and she was really promoting this, like, equity and diversity in AI.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much for tuning in. We really appreciate it. You've been listening to STEMinism. Again, this is CKUT 90.3 FM. Have a great rest of your Friday. Bye.
Is taken from CKUT's Time Capsule Archives. For more from our 35 years of freeform broadcasting, visit our website at ckut.ca.
18 hammers falling in our lives. There ain't no hammer down a ring like mine.
Yeah!
Funky Revolutions, for the fattest of the funk and other liberation musics. Saturdays, 2 to 4 p.m., pure funk and the shuffle of people marching in the streets. On CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Everything I do gonna be funky.
Revolution, yo. Check it out, check it out, check it out.
For your mind and for your hips, you're tuned to the Mothership. This is the Mothership Cassette Archives, 25 years of funky revolutions. Today's episodes, we begin to present a series on the development of soul, funk, jazz, and disco in South Africa, originally aired in the winter of 2015. On today's episode 10 of the Cassette Archives, we present first part one, Apartheid and the Diversity of Soul and Funk in South Africa, originally airing on 31st of January 2015, followed by part two of Censorship and the Role